We paved it over and swept it away as if it were, well, dirt. Then we woke to the fact that soil is where life begins and where life ends. And so today we pause to ask, can cows save the planet?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 922nd edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Puerto Montt who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Ricochet on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
And producer Kelly Bayer on the stories. Hello, Kelly. There we go, folks. Well, I guess you could file this one under Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, which is cheap food isn't. You've heard it said an apple a day keeps the doctor away. That advice may well have worked 80 years ago, but the apple has since lost about 50% of its calcium and over 80% of its phosphorus, iron, and magnesium. Therefore, to keep the doctor away today, we must have to eat about 5 apples a day. To understand what happened to the food in our food, let's look at the two ways in which we grow plants. One way, which we have come to call the organic way, is to feed the soil with organic material and then allow for the decomposition of that organic material in the soil to feed the plants. The other way, which we might call the synthetic way, is to simply bypass the soil and feed the plants directly with synthesized nutrients. This synthetic way of growing plants has given us a great amount of control over our environment and has allowed for the industrial scale with which we now grow our food. With that control, however, comes responsibility. We are now responsible for providing plants with all the nutrition they need. If we fail to provide plants with all the nutrients they need, the plants will fail to provide us with all the nutrients we need. Now, who among us is smart enough to know which nutrients plants need, in what quantity, and at what time? We do our best, of course, but given the nutritional quality of the modern apple and the state of our health, it seems as though we should be going to ground. And so today we go to ground with the question, can cows save the planet? Now, to help us answer that question, we have the author of Cows Save the Planet, Judy Schwartz. Judy, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Now, that's just the beginning of the title of your book. It also, in the title is, And Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. On Making the Deserts, Rethinking Climate Change, Bringing Back Biodiversity, and Restoring Nutrients to Our Food. That's a mouthful, girl.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, it is. I mean, the title is provocative, as it's intended to be, because it is a book about soil, and I wanted to reach a wider audience than, say, organic growers or soil scientists, so I wanted something catchy in there. But I will get to the cows, but just as I was listening to your intro, I think it's worth pointing out that the two methods that you described, one we might call the chemical approach and the other the biological approach.
Very good.
And the chemical approach basically reduces soil at this point when you take it to its local extreme, and in many places that's where it is right now. It basically reduces soil to this stuff that holds up a plant.
It's kind of an inert medium, essentially. And actually, if you talk to some growers, they would prefer an inert medium to one that's biologically active.
Right, but you start bumping up against some problems pretty quickly
Which is where we're going today. Well, Judy, listen, everybody in the world seems to want to be a greenie these days. They want to have green cars, they want to have green this, green that, they want to be green, they want to be a green business, everybody wants to be green. But I'm of the opinion that, you know, to get to green, we have to go to the brown first. And so I proudly feature myself as a brownie. And uh-huh. I'm wondering about you, Judy Schwartz. Are you a greenie or a brownie?
Well, I guess I talk the talk of a brownie, and do I walk the walk? Yeah, I give it a go. I'm a fledgling gardener, but I certainly support all the farmers, and I think about soil a lot, and I talk about soil a lot. So I guess that puts me in the brownie camp.
Well, let's ask this one. Can we be green without being brown? I mean, can we have a green environment and dead soil?
No, absolutely not. And soil really is the forgotten stuff of the environmental movement, I would say. And I think that because of that, we're missing lots of opportunities to really restore our environment and restore the natural cycles, because we can't do it without the whole cycle. You can't do just part of it. I can give a few examples just as an example with climate change, which, of course, okay, there are a couple of ways that soil has to do with climate change, but I'll start with one, the CO2 equation.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want you to hold that for just a little while, okay? Because
sure.
that's a big part of where we want to go, and
okay.
Because people just often think of soil as dirt and something that we pave over and sweep away and get out of the way. And as we have done that, we have turned to this synthetic or chemical way of growing our food, and we have thus really turned our soil into an inert medium, because we now believe that we can supply plants with all of their nutrients. But can we?
Yeah, I would say, and everyone that I've talked to would say, that what we're dealing with is such a complex, interconnected system that we can't do that. For example, okay, with the chemical model, which is where we've been focusing, we talk about the different macronutrients. Mm-hmm. But the micro...
Which is nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, right? NPK.
Right. Exactly. However, there are all kinds of micronutrients that, though in extremely, extremely small quantities, I mean, you know, like tiny, tiny, are still essential for the function of living cells.
Like boron and molybdenum and all of those things that nobody's ever heard of.
Exactly, exactly. So what you need is a system that can draw on those minerals in the soil and work with them and break them down so that they are available to plants. And without that, the plants can't be healthy. And without healthy plants, the animals, including us, can't be healthy too, either. I'm just thinking of a quote that I used that I referred to in the book, that there are formulas that may appeal to the, or ways of growing plants that may appeal to the chemist, but not to the cow. So.
And there you go.
Yeah. So what often happens is that when you pump up crops with, say, a lot of nitrogen, the plants may look big, but they really don't have much in them, because it's also telling the microorganisms in the soil to stop drawing on the nitrogen naturally. And then it's not a process. I'll just say since writing this book and thinking about these things, sometimes I think less of, when I think of food, a fruit or a vegetable, I think less of it as a thing than as a process, literally the fruit of a process, and therefore part of the process. And the same thing with soil, that we think of it, as you say, often as this inert matter, because if you look at it, it doesn't seem to be doing anything, but really it is a living organism and a collection of many. Yes.
And if it's not a living organism, we end up with the apple that is deficient in all of those things that used to keep the doctors away. And since they no longer have those things in them, those phosphorus and the potassium and molybdenum, all of those things that were once inside the apple and are now much reduced. So, and they're reduced in ourselves, and that they're reduced in our bodies means that we must go to the doctor. instead of staying away from the doctor. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. We're going to have some fun today talking dirt with Judy Schwartz, author of Cows That Save the Planet. Can't wait to hear how this is going to work, and I bet you can't either. So you just have to stay tuned, and also you may join us today if you so desire. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Curious to hear how you put life back into your soil. What do you do? Or is your soil dead? And if it is dead, what's going to happen to you? Those are the questions we've got on the table today on the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host. Judy Schwartz, your guest. Cows Save the Planet, the topic. Do stay tuned. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey there, welcome back. We're talking about how cows can save the planet. Now, isn't that the most bizarre thing you've ever heard, given what you've heard about cows and cattle and how they produce methane and eat grass and raise hell? Boy, how can cows possibly save the planet? And furthermore, how did a nice girl like Judy Schwartz end up writing about soil?
Oh, that's a question. I came at this as a journalist as opposed to a farmer or scientist. And I was writing about new economics, which is the notion that the purpose of the economy should be to serve people and the planet, as opposed to the other way around, which I fear is what we have, that the purpose of the people on the planet are to serve the economy, and that's getting way out of whack. So I approached that from many different angles and wrote a lot of articles, and at one conference, a man, a fellow named Will Rapp, up here in Vermont, who started the Gardener Supply Company, he made a statement that caught my attention. He said that over time, way more CO2 has gone into the atmosphere from agricultural practices compared to the burning of fossil fuels. And because that completely went against everything that I had thought was the case, my reaction was, why hadn't I heard this? And I want to find out more about this. And that's what led me to soil. And I found that as with the CO2 problem, many problems could be addressed and reversed by dealing on the level of the soil, by taking a soil's eye view of these concerns, which made me very optimistic. And I'm kind of a junkie for optimism. I'm kind of a hope junkie. So I kept going, and that's how it happened.
And there you are. So what led you to look down instead of up? I mean, all the other greenies in the world look up at into the sky and say we must end global warming by getting all the CO2 out of the sky. And you're looking at the ground and saying, well, wait a minute.
Well, because once you understand that much of the CO2 was carbon that had been in the soil and functioning, helping the soil function, because carbon is an important part of the soil, that has gone into the atmosphere and oxidized to form CO2. Once you understand that, then it kind of flips things around. So instead of panic, I do absolutely think we need to greatly reduce emissions, but I think that the news is so frightening to people that they just, and it's so frustrating to hear about one global conference after another where no advances are made, that people tune out. Whereas with soil, we can bring CO2, we can bring the carbon back into the ground merely by working with biological processes. And in doing so, we're also improving the soil, improving soil fertility, improving its ability to hold water, which is really, really crucial, because the deadness of the soil that today can no longer hold water has a lot to do with the flooding and drought cycle that we're having. So once you see that you can look at this another way and make not only resolve the problem that you were concerned about, but also solve other problems too, well, that got me very, very excited. But unfortunately, we're only hearing half the story.
Well, first of all, why are we hearing only half the story?
Wow, that is a big question, and I don't...
I guess that would be kind of a political question, right? And if we ask those kinds of questions, we end up with our feet in the honey bucket trying to figure out how to get out. Let's go back...
And the way, also, just the way that oh, goodness, just the way that we all accept things and just the way that ideas can become almost institutionalized. Anyway, let's go on. That is a different big question.
Let's back up just a little bit and talk about the Keeling curve. It's part of your presentation about carbon sequestration in the soil. So let's start there.
Okay, so most of the way that we think about climate change and the rise of CO2 is through this diagram called the Keeling curve, which measures the concentrations of CO2 in parts per million in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have recently cracked 400, the 400 point. And so that resulted in a lot of media and
press releases.
And most of it saying, we're here, what do we do now? What do we do now? We have to reduce the fossil fuel emissions, but we haven't gotten anywhere about that. But see, the Keeling curve is very accurate for what it measures, but it doesn't say where the CO2 comes from and where it could potentially go. So that's where the soil is a really important part of this, because over time we've lost like in the tens, possibly hundreds of gigatons of carbon from the soil. So a lot of that carbon in the atmosphere wants to be in the soil. And another thing that
country roads, right?
Yes.
So, with respect to the carbon in the sky, we think, well, the only way to get rid of the carbon in the sky is by reducing our emissions of fossil fuels, our burning of fossil fuels, and by using windmills or something like that. But that's not the only way, is it?
No. And the challenge with that is that takes time, that some of that is... We're not going to just turn off all our cars and shut down all the plants and it's going to obediently go down. No, it would take a century or so.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it. And then people do talk about geoengineering. When we hit 400, I noticed that there were a lot of reports about someone has this idea and you vacuum clean and you sulfurize and you do this. But I feel really strongly, just having watched the development of how scientific ideas are applied, we cannot remote control our way out of this. We need to work with biological systems,
well,
and that's what soil offers.
Judy Schwartz, rumor has it that plants have something to do with removing carbon dioxide from the air.
Indeed. Thank you for reminding me. Yes, the process of photosynthesis. Plants take in carbon.
Carbon dioxide.
Right, and they release oxygen. So the more plants we have, the more this process goes on, and that does actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere.
And then once we start talking about the more plants we have, of course, we get back to being a brownie and talking about the soil we have.
That's right, because we need living, functioning soil in order to sustain those plants. So there's... Yeah, again, this is good news because there are a lot of areas where we're not taking advantage of the land's potential to carry plants.
Now, you made mention of the fact that, first of all, do you think we can do it without living soil? Do you think we can do it with the inert soils of industrial agriculture?
No, no, we definitely can't. However, soil can be restored. It's very responsive to good stewardship. But, yeah.
You gave a great example in the Gobi Desert of restoring soil. How did that work?
In China?
Yes, sure. Chungwa.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly how it was, but a lot of it has to do.
There was a story about a plateau.
That's right, the Loess Plateau.
Yes,
because basically the Chinese government realized that the sediment from all the soil erosion was dealing with that was much more costly than restoring the land. So they worked with villagers, so that gave employment to villagers in this very rural area.
The size of what? It was a huge area.
Yeah, it was a huge area. I forget the size of some European country. I remember. Belgium comes to mind, but
yeah.
Don't quote me on that. So a lot of it has to do with creating areas where water can stay, because to grow plants and get the soil working again, you need water.
But
so,
to make a long story short, they rebuilt the soil, and the soil rebuilt the environment, right?
Yes. And see, that's what's so exciting, is that when you begin to restore land, you restore the soil, you get greater biodiversity, you have happy microorganisms, which create happy plants.
And happy us. Oh, my God, this is good news. Stay tuned for more. Right back. Oh, my goodness, I think we lost her. Yep, sounds like we lost our poor Miss Judith here, so we're going to have to go get her again. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Mike Lowson tuned with your guest who's coming back to us, Judy Schwartz. She's the author of Cows Save the Planet. Folks, let me ask you this. Who among us is smart enough to know what plants need and how much of it they need and when they need it? See, with the new synthetic technologies of modern agriculture, in which we kind of bypass the soil processes, we must become the stewards of those plants. We must provide them with all of the nutrition they need. And if we don't provide those plants with the nutrition they need, where are they going to get it? They aren't going to get it. So those plants then become deficient, and we become deficient. And what happens when we become deficient? Then we find ourselves in deep trouble, and the kind of trouble that ends up taking us to the doctor because we are deficient. So how do we go back to the soil, a different way of doing things, rebuild the soil so that the soil can take care of us? It seems so simple, Judy, that all we have to really do is to build the soil, and the soil takes care of things. Is it that simple?
Well, in some ways it is, but then we're also dealing with a situation where our soils have been so mistreated that we need to really work at it.
So it's like restoring the soil.
Yes, very much so. I mean, there are growers that do tell me that it can be as simple as adding minerals, rock dust,
mm-hmm.
or it also depends on what the condition of the land is. So,
Judy, I once had the opportunity to visit a farm in the Shenandoah River Valley of Virginia, and named Joel's Hallaton, and I went there, and there were people standing in line waiting to buy us chickens, and so I walked up to the lady at the back of the line and noticed that most of the license plates were from Washington, D.C., and I said, "Ma'am, did you just drive all the way from Washington, D.C. to buy a chicken?" And she said, "Oh, no, I came here to buy a Joel's Hallaton chicken," and I thought, that's pretty interesting. So what is it about Joel's Hallaton chickens? Well, Joel's Hallaton is a grass farmer, by that he means that he grows grass and then feeds animals and then he sells the animals. But grass is what he grows. So he took me out to his pasture one afternoon, and there was a light rain falling. And his grass was this beautiful, deep blue-green color, and it was standing up tall and proud in the light rain. And he said, I want you to come with me. And he walked me over to the fence line. And on the other side of the fence, the grass was dull gray-brown and fallen down in the rain. And there it was, just as plain as day. And after that visit, I kept trying to figure out how I could stuff some of Joel Salatin's chickens into my suitcase and fly them back to California, because that's the kind of food I want to eat, because that's the kind of food that has, I think, has all the nutrition in it that my body needs. And so how on earth do we rebuild that soil with cows? The title of your book, Cows Save the Planet. You got to come clean here, girl. How on earth does this work?
Okay. All right. So, livestock, and that could be cows, it could be sheep, it could be goats, any grass-eating animal, are the centerpiece of a practice that can restore land, most specifically grasslands, on a large scale. Okay? Mm-hmm. So the animals are used as tools, and this practice is called holistic management or holistic planned grazing when you're actually talking about the grazing part. Now, I don't know a whole lot. I've read a little bit about Joel Salatin's land.
Well, you could introduce us to Alan Savory.
Let's do that. Okay. So Alan Savory I know that Joel Salatin does something similar,
right,
but he's also not on a dry landscape, so some of the requirements of what he needs to do is different. But basically, the idea that I think Joel Salatin has brought out to people is that you can't keep taking out of the soil. You also have to put in, okay? So using the biological processes. Now, Alan Savory developed this holistic management framework. He was a wildlife biologist in what is now Zimbabwe, and this was in the 50s, and he noticed that whenever they were preparing the game parks, they were setting aside land for game parks. And sometimes when they set aside the land, they said, this land has had too many animals on it, let's rest it, okay? So they would have land that had no animals on it. And he noticed that the land deteriorated further. And this was a paradox, because if the problem was that there were too many animals, well then, why would it be worse when you remove the animals? So it occurred to him two things. One is maybe the land needs animals in the same way animals need the land, and the other is something has gone awry with the way that animals naturally move around the land, we need to manage the animals. So over a long time, he developed this practice, which involves moving animals on the land.
Which essentially is what Joel Salatin does. He moves animals across the land.
Right. Alan Savory's work is its best use and most exciting use, because with, I don't know how many acres Joel Salatin has, but we're talking what Alan Savory and people at the Savory Institute are talking about are huge, vast areas of either deteriorating or actually desertified land that has lost its ability to function in seasonal environments, with areas that have seasonal rain. And that's where it's different in the Shenandoah Valley, because that's a moist climate. You see, our deserts are spreading. When I say deserts, it's kind of tricky. I don't mean the natural desert ecosystems. I mean that you have land that had been productive, but the way that the land has been used is basically mining all the nutrients. It's drying out. It's no longer functioning. So when you bring cattle on that land, then, and manage them in a specific way that it mimics the behavior of the wild animals, you know, the wild herbivores moving across all the continents, that you can restore the land, because they act upon it in very, very specific ways. So then when you
talk about restoring the land, you're not only talking about restoring the land, you're talking about restoring the soil and then the land and then the entire world above the land.
Yes, yes, you can bring back. It all works together. That by the cattle moving, the cattle nibble, they eat down on the grasses to expose the grasses to the growth points, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So to sunlight. Their hoofs, they press in seeds so that they're exposed, so that they have good soil contact, and that improves biodiversity because there are some seeds that didn't get into the soil profile. They're also pressing decaying matter into the soil so that the microorganisms can get at them.
Oh my God, Judy Schwartz, are you saying cows are good?
It depends how they manage,
right. Okay,
they
folks, we're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to the phones. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Is your soil alive or is it dead? Right back. Well, folks, one way or another, we have to feed the plants everything they need, or they won't supply us with everything we need. And if we don't get everything we need, we're going to be in big trouble. So how do we supply the plants with everything they need? Judy Schwartz, author of Cows Save the Planet, is suggesting that we can do it with the help of animals. What kind of animals, Judy?
They're any grazing animal, any domestic grazing animal. I mean, the wild animals would be great, but we don't have the land for mm-hmm. that right now.
I was just thinking of having a herd of buffalo in my backyard. It might get interesting.
Sure, give it a go.
but there are people talking about bringing buffalo back for the same reason you're talking about, which is that when the buffalo were grazing the American plains, they managed the plant growth quite well that way, right?
Yeah. Again, it would really depend on it, in our day and age, and given our land, the spread of our population, and just the amount of land and where the boundaries would be, I would imagine that it would need some definite management. Because part of the equation is that you also need predators.
Mm-hmm.
In nature, and this was one of Alan Savory's observations, is that, let's say you're in Africa and you have a herd of zebra and they're grazing, so you don't want the animals to graze too long. But in a state of nature, then the lion would come along, the animals would bunch up together, and they would flee as a group and trample everything down. Okay? So the land looks awful. However, that trampling stimulates all those biological processes.
And
it also means, that the land isn't overgrazed. So when in doing holistic management, then the land manager moves the animal, in a way acts as the predator. Making sure that they move.
Interesting. I'm just looking at a story about how white-tailed deer are overrunning America. And the reason, of course, is that there are no predators. Hey, let's go to the phones and talk. The phone number is today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Thomas is on the line. Welcome aboard, Thomas.
Hey, good morning. It's an interesting subject. I thank you for sharing it with all of us. I had a question because this has been a subject dear to me for 20, 30, 40 years about our soil, and I'm convinced that just feeding the soil is the answer for healthy humans. And I had two questions, but I'll start with one and see if you have time. And one is that I was in Hawaii living a couple years ago, and I was exploring this subject, and I came across somebody like Joe Salazin who was moving their animals around and around and allowing the land to rest in between. And I was on YouTube, I think, or somewhere that offered a lot of films, and they showed me another man in England who was, I think, 70 or 80 at the time, but he had spent 20 years creating his pastures, and he created them to such a degree of diversity and health that he could graze his cows there, and they would never, ever, ever damage the pasture. They never had to worry about overgrazing because the pastures were so lush and so nutritious that his cows could feed, become incredibly healthy, and he would use the animals, I suppose, for food at times. But the pasture was never, ever depleted. It was continuously more healthy, and it was never overgrazed. And I wondered if anybody knew of that man, because I think now he's given this farm to his son and daughter, and they still do the same thing with this pasture and soil. And
that's an incredible notion that you could actually build soil to be so healthy that it could just take care of you. Is that possible, Judy?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't heard of this particular person, but what this story makes me think of is the fact that we have not even looked at the potential for what we can do, that our sense of what's okay, we've gotten used to such depleted food, such depleted land, that our expectations are really, really low. So the possibility of restoration and improvement is just so huge.
Okay.
So that's, yeah.
There it is. A quick follow-up, Thomas?
Yeah, the quick follow-up is if the man does exist, the place does exist, and he has done what I just described to you.
Now you're teasing us, Thomas. So your job is now to go find out who that person is and log on the answer on the food chain page at metrofarm.com. There's a forum there you can put this name on, and that's your job, and you have to do it or you're going to be in big trouble. So let's go to Teresa. Teresa, welcome to the food chain.
Thank you, Michael. I wanted to say that if you wanted to get that Joel Salatin chicken right here and do exactly what Judith is talking about, we have the same model going on in Pescadero.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's ask Judy. Judy, is this something that is happening to American agriculture? Are people actually returning to this model of a biodiverse soil supporting the food animals? Or are we stuck in this Smithfield model? Whereas, the Chinese just bought out Smithfield Foods, and so we're now relying on Smithfield Foods to provide our meat. It seems like we're heading in two really opposite directions here. Is there any hope? We're going to have to take a quick break, but let's pick up what Teresa is pointing at. Is it possible that we can have a soil like our friend was talking about in England that is so rich and so fertile that it can support an animal population that is so healthy that they don't need drugs and antibiotics and can supply us with all of the nutrition that we need? Or are we stuck with this model of Smithfield Foods and in these giant industrial factories, you know, and feeding those animals soybeans and corn that have been, you know, genetically engineered to withstand glyphosate and to include pesticides? And I don't know. There's two different directions. Are we stuck with the big one? Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, okay, folks, what do you think? Are we stuck with this industrial model of food production that relies on synthetic inert soils, nutrients derived from mineral salts, pesticides, herbicides, genetically engineered foods, mass factories of thousands and thousands of animals? Or is it possible to look into another direction in which we rely on the soil? Teresa, what do you think?
Well, I think it's not going to happen without a partnership between consumers and producers. What we're doing in our neighborhood is community-supported animal husbandry, where we partner with the Pescadero Ranch so that the chickens that follow the cows that they have for Left Coast beef, then we get those chickens and people can subscribe for a chicken every other week. They can get pork and sausage and bacon from the pigs that live in the forest fringe and eat the acorns. So with that, they can have a model that is predictable, and we can contribute to sustaining that soil.
Wow. Judy?
Yeah, I think that's pretty exciting. And then there you go. There are many ways to accomplish this, and this particular kind of partnership sounds like a real good one.
So I have a sneaking suspicion I'm talking with two optimists. You know, I mean, in all seriousness, it's been so serious lately. I mean, if we don't do something, carbon dioxide is going to smother us to death. We have to quit driving our cars. We have to erect windmills. We have to do this. We have to look to the sky to fix everything. But no. we can look to the soil. And it's much simpler, isn't it, to fix the soil as a starting place at least, Judy?
I would say so, absolutely. And it's so responsive. And when you think about it, it makes so much sense because all of the important biological, biophysical cycles move through the soil, the nutrient cycle, the carbon cycle, the energy cycle, and the water cycle. So that working on the level of soil gives us, to use a business phrase, leverage on these cycles in order to restore them.
Teresa, are you a greenie or a brownie?
I'd never thought about it that way before, but I would have to say I am a brownie. It really comes back to the soil.
Are you as optimistic as Judy is? Do you think we can take care of ourselves by taking care of our soil? I mean, it sounds so simple.
I think we're going to have to, and that it's happening in other countries maybe faster than it is here, because we haven't had to depend on that. But it's a fine line between being an optimist and a pessimist that I think things are going to get worse before they get better.
Judy?
Yeah, I would agree that we have to start to think about things differently and think more about the process than the product. Or when we think about the product, such as food, we also need to think about the process that yields it. You see, all the biotech and all that can mask some problems for a while, but it's going to kick back at us. You know, as one of my sources said, nature always bats last.
Can cows save the planet?
Well, they can certainly restore a lot of land. And the way I think of it is that you can create pockets of restoration and then, you know,
Judy Schwartz. Cows can save the planet. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you all for tuning in. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live. Thank you.